Well, as we talk about today, what we're going to be doing over the next 2 weeks is talking about a series called Elephants in the Church. And it's some of these topics where you might say, you know, Pastor, it's good that you go through the book of, you go through a book of a Bible, or you talk about Christian things, that's great. But what about issues that confront our culture, of which there seem to be more and more and more? Not just does the Bible have something to say about it, but does the church, does the community have something to say in response to these things? We realize today, as we start this look, it's a two-week series on the sanctity of life, and we're talking this week about the beginning of life and the tragic ending before it begins called abortion, and next week we're looking at the end of life, euthanasia, and all of the issues with that. What I want to say, two things from the outset, is number one, we're not going to be able to cover absolutely everything in our time here over the next 2 weeks. There will be questions that you go home with and issues that you probably want to raise that we just don't have the forum to in this time. You might be here today and you are not a follower of Jesus. And you might say, Jeff, everything you say, I walk out of here and I disagree with. To which I would say, that's okay. We all here want to know truth. We want to know, is there a way that we can move forward? And so in kind of saying, well, there's so many things and it's so complex, where do we begin? We actually believe there is some way to navigate through these things, and we want to talk about abortion in this issue today. But you also might be here, and maybe in your walk of life and in your experience so far, this issue of abortion has only been either something you've read about or maybe just vaguely thought about, but maybe you're here this morning and it's hit much closer to home. Maybe you know someone that the ripple effect of abortion has been in, that you've been in that ripple somewhere, a close friend, a family member, maybe yourself. Maybe you're a guy here who maybe you pressured your spouse into having an abortion, and maybe you've had one yourself here this morning. I want to just let you know, as we talk about community and the church's response, please don't hear it as a place of judgment. Please don't hear us say you're a bad person and you're not qualified for the kingdom of God. Not at all. We are a place where we believe that because of Jesus, he restores all of us. And in him, there's a place of healing and restoration and forgiveness and wholeness. And so I pray that that's what we hear as we go through both of these weeks. And like I said, today is this whole issue of abortion, which is complex, which is serious, which the church, and I believe because of Scripture and what God has told us, has a response about this idea and the importance of sanctity of life. And so I want to begin today by inviting Alexa Wojcik up. And she's going to read a true story of a woman from our greater church family. This is not Alexa's personal story, but she's reading it on behalf of someone in our church who wants to remain anonymous, someone who had an abortion 20 years ago. Alexa, would you come?
Till now, this story has been shared only with close family, a few select friends, a counselor, and more recently, a pastor. I'm telling it from my perspective, but it's important to add that it's also my husband's story, and we've carried this burden together. It is my hope and that my story will be helpful to others who find themselves in a similar situation. My first pregnancy ended early in miscarriage. Of course, this is not uncommon, but it was still very sad, and the sense of loss became even harder as we waited to get pregnant again, wondering if it would ever happen. I tried to be positive, not anxious, and focus on looking forward. But eventually, when my body was finally ready, I once again became pregnant with another baby. We were thrilled. I live with health issues that I have to manage on a daily basis, and these problems do add some risks to pregnancy. So I was committed to doing all I could to keep the baby inside me healthy. I'd be carefully monitored by doctors throughout the pregnancy to give both the baby and myself the highest possible success rate. So when an irregularity was detected about 16 weeks in, the specialist I was seeing sent me for a detailed ultrasound and recommended that my husband be there with me for the appointment. Of course, we both wanted to be there, but his suggestion made us somewhat concerned. The ultrasound revealed a healthy, growing baby, and the technician carefully measured and analyzed him. Then a doctor took over the ultrasound exam. she showed us that there was not just one, but two babies growing inside of me. This was incredibly exciting news, and again, we were thrilled to think of all that we could start to look forward to. But our delight was quickly tempered when the doctor went on to explain that the second baby was a lot smaller and had a serious and irreversible birth defect. My husband and I went from elation to devastation in that ultrasound room that day, and we left there with heavy hearts. More appointments quickly followed, where we learned more about the immediate as well as the long-term struggles that would be faced by the smaller baby if he survived the birth. And we also heard about the option of selective reduction. Selective reduction was the terminology used, but it basically means aborting one of the two babies. The doctors and other professionals were all very kind and informative and not pushy in any way, but they were also quite matter-of-fact about the medical options available. We were left with a big decision to make and a short time in which to make it. Our families were informed about the situation, and there were many among them who were praying for us. We knew we had their support no matter what, but it was and still is a very difficult subject to talk about. It would have been so helpful for us to have been in more conversations with others at that time. I wish we had more time to seek out good counsel, although we really didn't know where to find it. Looking back, I wish we had been involved in a church community at the time, but we were not. My husband and I took what little time we had and did pray and ask God to help us through this as we tried to decipher what we should do. We chose in the end to abort the smaller baby. I still hate to say that. It was an incredibly hard decision to make, but I believe we did it for good reasons, and I know many of you may not understand or agree. I know that the little one went into the hands of Jesus when his spirit left my womb. I know that his life on earth would have been full of pain, hardship, if he had lived, but he is whole in heaven. I know that caring for a disabled child with all that it would entail might have been detrimental to my own health, as well as to the overall health of the other healthy baby. I felt like we were choosing to save the little one from a very difficult existence on earth, and we are enabling his brother to have a fuller and better life. I also know that God forgives. I would say that my decision to have an abortion was made for all the right reasons, but ultimately, it has been a very difficult decision to live with. It was always in the back of my mind. I often feel terrible that we denied that little one the opportunity to live, and I realized that I really had no right to make that call. I feel I must be weak for choosing not to accept the challenge of parenting a child with special needs. And I'm sorry that my other children do not know their brother. I often feel very selfish for having done what I did. But I know that God forgives, and I've confessed this sin and received his forgiveness, and so I am forgiven. I know that God still loves me and values me and has a good plan for me. The words in a Matt Redman song called You Never Let Go have spoken to me over the years. My Lord is with me, he will never let me go, through the calm and through the storm, through the highs and the lows. Sometimes it's tough to really believe this and accept his grace, which I really don't deserve, but that is the place where my hope is found. I just have to cling to him and trust him. Though this is a painful story, it is my hope that the Lord will find a way to use it for good and make something positive out of it.
Thank you, Alexa. And as you can tell firsthand from this woman who has shared this from her past, this is not an easy topic. It's a heavy one. So where do we go from here? Well, we're going to turn to our authority on life and life's matters first. We hold to the Bible as our ultimate authority for life and for teaching. And so I want to turn there before we look at anything else to look at this subject. Now, here's the thing, though. As we look at Scripture, here's our immediate potential problem. is that the Bible doesn't mention abortion. Not once, not anywhere in all 66 books of the Bible, not once is abortion mentioned. But while we could say, well, then we dismiss the Bible as an authoritative book on the matter, we don't. Because we do see that the Bible speaks with great authority on the value of the life in a mother's womb. So let me explain what I mean by walking through a few key passages in the Bible that we need to know. Very first, and this is kind of our foundation of how we actually can build anything in regards to our stance in a Christian response to abortion, other than just saying, well, I think it's wrong. You know, on 208, we see the foundations being laid for major buildings, condos and homes and different things. And without a proper foundation, the building can crumble. And here is our foundation of what we build, the argument of the dignity and the value of life before birth. We go back to the very first book of the Bible, in the very first chapter, in Genesis chapter 1. And it says there in verse 27, listen to this. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. This verse, the foundation of all of this, talks about the image of God, or a Latin term called imago Dei. Imago Dei, the image of God. In other words, to be made, formed, shaped, and wired in the image of our Creator. Think about that for a moment. The one who spoke stars into existence, the one that we look at mountains and go, wow, those are beautiful, that God created, actually has his fingerprints over every single one of us. Now, we may say, you know, our child can look like us or act like us. For proof, I look no further than our 5-year-old, who everyone calls a little Michelle. Both in looks and her spunkiness, it's striking, it's crazy. But to be made in the image of our Creator goes much deeper than that. We don't just resemble, but we have the fingerprints of our Creator on us. And I think that there's something both beautiful and mysterious about that. And because of this imago Dei in Genesis 1 that we see, giving every human being dignity, it's widespread and it's across all spectrums. Regardless of gender, income bracket, faith, race, or even our sports team preference, we're all given on equal grounds dignity. Now, we have to make sure we get this. The image of God is embedded into humanity across the board. Because it gives then every single human being dignity and worth. That is our foundation for which everything will spring off of. Well, we may say, well, that's just obvious, isn't it, Jeff? All of us as human beings have dignity, all of us have worth. But it's not, and that's why we need to make sure we get this. Because we could say it's common sense that every human being has dignity, even apart from God, Jeff, don't they? But no. In fact, history has shown us that this is not the case, that everybody just universally believes this. For instance, the Nazi Germans believed that Jewish people were subhuman, for example, and because of that, therefore, they did not have human dignity or any right to life. The same is true for the Hutus in Rwanda about their countrymen, the Tutsis, in the mid-1990s, which sparked a civil war and a genocide. They did it justifying themselves on the basis that the Tutsis were not human and therefore did not have dignity. There are so many other examples, including the Expendables in India even today. The lowest of the lows in their class caste system, they believe, are not actually human beings with life and worth. Scripture comes along and says God breathes on us and he has his fingerprint on us. And so therefore, because of this imago Dei, all of us have dignity by the nature of being created. One popular view on why certain people have human rights is held by a professor of bioethics at Princeton University, a gentleman by the name of Peter Singer. He argues this. He argues humans have worth only as it relates to capacity. So, in other words, because we contribute to society, we have worth. It's kind of similar to saying, you know, if you've got kids this morning, our kids only have worth so long as they do their chores at home and help keep up their end of the bargain at home. If they are a value add, they have rights. But get this. This is a quote from him, Peter Singer himself, in 1979. He said this, because newborns don't contribute in ways comparable to adults, he says this, human babies are not self-aware, and so therefore they are not persons. And therefore the life of a newborn, listen here, is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. To argue Singer's comments, Pastor Tim Keller from New York says this, if you don't believe in the image of God, what are you going to ground? What is your foundation? What are you going to ground human rights in? You're going to ground it in its capacities. If you can't protect the unborn, then you also can't protect the newly born. You can't protect the mentally handicapped. You can't protect old people. In fact, it's a fact, and it's logical. So what I want us to see in this, first of all, is this grounding, this foundation of which we understand because our Creator has created us, our human rights and our dignity in life is based on this imago Dei. Christians as a whole ground our ethics in this truth of imago Dei. Now, staying in Scripture, with that said and with that foundation laid, the Bible also talks about humans being born in the image of God, and the Bible tells us and gives us beautiful pictures of God's love for us even well before we were born. He talks about his love for us while we were still in our mother's womb. One of the most popular, but I think it's popular for a reason, and I want us just to sit in this for a minute as I read it. It's from a book in the Bible called Psalms. Psalms are essentially a collection of letters to God. And a mighty king in Israel by the name of David wrote this psalm, not only about who he was, but how he knew God saw him. Listen to these words in Psalm 139. For you, God, created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. I love this. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them ever came to be. What a beautiful picture of God knowing us, having his fingerprint on us, and loving us in the mother's womb. Now, we move on to the New Testament, to the Gospel of Luke. Check this out, because this is a really interesting way, and not an accidental way, that the Greek language tells us about how it looks at human beings, especially children inside the womb and out. First of all, Luke chapter 1. It tells us the moment when Mary, who's carrying Jesus, meets Elizabeth. It says in Luke 1, verses 39 to 41, at that time, Mary got ready and hurried to a town in the hill country of Judea, where she entered Zechariah's home and greeted Elizabeth. Listen to 41. When Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting, the baby, now the Greek word here is brephos, which is an unborn child, the brephos leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. I don't know what that would feel like. I'm a guy, but it would feel probably pretty weird. But still, the baby leaped in her womb. Now, it's pretty cool that the baby John leaps. But now, notice this. This same word, brephos, is used for a baby after birth. So let's put our Christmas hats on for a moment. We're already halfway there anyway. It's June, folks. So hopefully you're shopping and getting ready for it. But while we're there, listen to Luke 2, verse 12. The angels appeared to shepherds and told them to go and see Jesus. And Luke 2, 12 says to us, it says, this will be a sign to you. You will find a baby, a briphos, a newborn child, wrapped in clothes or cloths and lying in a manger. Did you catch that? The word baby, the Greek word briphos, is used to describe a baby both in the womb and a newborn child. In the biblical worldview, a child is a child, whether in the womb or not. Dr. Seuss, in his book, Horton Hears a Who, actually stole the page out of this, right out of the Gospel of Luke, when he says, a person's a person, no matter how small. So, let me just recap here in what Scripture tells us. Our foundation, everything is built on this idea of Imago Dei, the image of God. God has his hand upon us, God has his fingerprints on us, and he created us. And so therefore we have importance and dignity in life. And God also has a lot to say through the Psalms, through Luke, and many other places about human beings inside the womb, not just the moment they're born and here on after. But what about science? What about science? What does science actually say about this issue? And I know there's so much. Again, this is so hard to talk and tackle in a short amount of time, but there's important things that we need to notice. And in fact, science does talk about this issue. What I'm going to share with you can be found from a video series called the Life Tour Videos. And it's on a website, and I want to put it up here so you guys can see this and look at it at some point, maybe this week. It's called weneedalaw.ca. Specifically, a man by the name of Andre Schouten talks about a lot of these things, about how science and faith can interact, and scientifically speaking, speaks actually a lot to the idea of the dignity of life. He says that there are many things to consider ethically and scientifically from a field of study called the science of embryology. Here's three things that he says that we need to know and understand whether we are followers of Jesus or not. Number one, embryology teaches that the baby is complete. From the moment of fertilization, from the moment the egg and the sperm fuse together, the child is complete. The child is whole. There is no add-on after this, rather only an environment that it needs to grow. The child is not fully developed, but the child is whole. I remember Michelle and I, with each of our four children, we went onto this website. I can't remember what it's called. I can't direct you to it, but I'm sure there's a number of them that do this now. But every single week, you would go on there and you could see where, what stage the baby was at as it was growing. From just this little thing, this little zygote, or whatever it's called. I'm not a scientist, I don't know. But until it's fully formed. And it's like, you know, at this particular week, arms started growing. And we're like, yay, that's great, our baby's got arms. You know, the nose starts to grow. And then the baby can see, and the baby can hear. And you're like, unbelievable that nothing is added into this equation, but the baby begins to grow. All it needs is time and a safe environment. What the website should say is, and at year two, the baby will develop something called an attitude. And at year 12, I don't want to go to year 12. I don't want to jump that far in advance. But anyway, what I'm saying is this, is that it is complete. And I think that's a beautiful sight to see, is that even though, you know, it takes time, that everything is there. Number two, embryology in the science and study of this teaches that the baby is unique. Genetics show us that the child is unique and distinct from her mother. Yes, dependent on her mother for life, but still completely unique and individual. This is important. She is not just an appendage. She has her own hair color, eye color, and blood type. The DNA tells us this. She is distinct from her mother. She is inside her mother, and yet she is her own individual. Very important. And number three, embryology teaches us that the baby is a person. So this is what I mean by this. Living things produce their own kind, which you might say that's obvious, but let me just take this argument just a few steps further. Living things will produce their own kind. In other words, two monkeys that mate will produce what? A monkey. It's not a trick question. That's the answer. It's a monkey. If two dogs mate, you will not get a horse. You will get a dog. Although some dogs seem like a horse because they're so big, but you'll still get a dog. And if we carry that further, similar beings produce their own kind. If two humans mate, they will get a human being, not a blob of cells or a blob of tissue. Not a blob of cells or tissue that later become a human. Humans who mate produce human beings. To sum all of this up from a very, very short look at science is this amazing, awesome quote from Professor H. Gordon from Mayo Clinic. In his years and years and years of study and practice, he concludes with this. He says, by all the criteria of modern molecular biology, life is present from the moment of conception. So this isn't just the church standing on a soapbox saying this, but there's a lot of science that supports this idea that life is present from the moment of conception. Now, do we need to take a breath? This is a lot of information, and this is heavy. But I think through all this, we can articulate that as followers of Jesus, we don't just close our eyes and respond again with this idea that abortion is wrong because it's wrong. And if someone presses you on it, just say, I don't know. Go talk to somebody else. But it's just not right. Now, I know that there are many, many questions and many scenarios that we could actually talk about and say, yes, Jeff, but what about? But what about and what about? I know that. I don't even know all of the questions that we may ask. But let me just approach and confront two questions that often come up in regards to this idea of abortion. I get that it's, okay, maybe not the best thing or the rightest thing all the time, but what about, and here's the first one that I want to talk about, what about women's rights? What about the woman's right to choose what happens to her own body? Well, the infamous case of Roe versus Wade in 1973 began to pave the way not for women's rights, those began much, much earlier in terms of things like women's right to vote, hold office, etc. That wasn't the issue with Roe versus Wade. But it was actually to prioritize women's rights over those of the unborn child. Now, there can be public misconception then that the church doesn't value women if they go against the Roe versus Wade ruling. Nothing can be further from the truth. Remember the Imago Dei verse in Genesis chapter 1? It includes all human beings, and I love the fact that God made it gender inclusive on purpose. Women aren't in brackets or parentheses. It doesn't just say man, meaning everybody. God intentionally says male and female. He created them. So yes, absolutely, the Christian faith champions women's rights. But watch carefully, because of the Imago Dei, because of that foundation that is built, that God breathes on us, and therefore all of us have equal dignity, because of the fact that a child is a human being from the moment of conception, and therefore given dignity, because the Creator himself has his fingerprints on him, the right for a human to live always wins over the right to choose. Those are tough words to listen to for some people, and some that somewhat outright dismiss that. But based on Imago Dei and the rights of human beings to live, it's a simple order of priority that we value human life and the right to live over the right to choose. Let me say something else about Roe versus Wade while we're here. In the U.S. Supreme Court ruling of this, even in siding with women's rights, the wording was very careful to express concern for the unborn, and conditions had to be met for the abortion to take place. It wasn't just a open ticket, but all of these conditions had to be met. Now, I'm not condoning or applauding that in any way, but from that ruling, a slippery slope has taken place to allow more and more freedom and more liberty for abortions to take place. Did you know this? That since 1988, for now almost 30 years, Canada, our own nation in which we live, has had no regulations, none, regarding preborn children at any stage of pregnancy? Hear that. In other words, abortions can take place at any time while the child is in the womb. This is the country we live in, and these are the absence of laws that we live with. The only other two countries in the world that are like us are China and North Korea. And that should shock us. Even secular pluralist countries like France, Spain, and Germany all limit abortions to the first trimester. Now, is this the best law for all of us to hold to in regards to the sanctity of life? No. But it's definitely better than what we have now. And again, I would point you back to that website, weneedalaw.ca, for more information, and perhaps a Christian response out of that of what we can do. So what about women's rights? That's one topic, and we could talk further about that. But I want to address something in my time that I've got left here to talk about one other issue and one other question that comes up. And that is the issue of this. Jeff, what about this horrifying event called rape and the resulting pregnancy that may come from that? I will say that this has to be one of the most painful and terrifying, dehumanizing things to ever happen to another human being. And first and foremost, the church as a whole and every church community is called to care for human life, for women, and for women who have gone through this horrific experience. And I would hope that women would find that within the church walls that there's a place of safety and acceptance and support. But we must know this. From a biblical viewpoint, this baby is a person, not just a clump of cells. This baby is a life, known by his or her creator, loved by his or her creator, fearfully and wonderfully made in the imago Dei, in the image of God. And so in all of this, what is the Christian response? If we are a follower of Jesus, what do we do? I think there's something so much more powerful that we could do than simply wear a sandwich board and go and shame people walking to abortion clinics and screaming at them and shouting names at them. I think there's so much more that we can do than just stand on a soapbox and push our beliefs down other people's throats. The answer, I think, lies in the fact that we must not only believe in pro-life, but be prepared to practice it. And this is where maybe it gets tougher, because we don't want it to become personal. We don't want to have to invest something in this. But friends, we need to live as if the gospel has changed us, knowing that it has. We need to live as good news people. We need to celebrate the Imago Dei in each other. The fact that we were created equal, maybe some a little bit smarter, maybe some a little bit better looking, but still equal. It is no good being pro-life if all that means is what we are anti-abortion. To be pro-life is to welcome pregnant women with grace and tangible love. To be pro-life is to care for single mothers who have little support around them. And I would say single fathers. Yes, single fathers. There's an amazing ministry in Surrey through a ministry called Youth Unlimited, where they actually come alongside, support, and equip young fathers whose either wife or girlfriend or significant other has left the scene for some reason. And you may wonder, does this actually happen? Like, is this real? Youth Unlimited right now works with over 40 young dads in Surrey who this very situation has happened with them. That they are left with either from a newborn through to whatever age child, and they're simply going, I don't know what to do, but I want to keep this child. So will you help me? And it's amazing. I was talking to Matt Bergen, who works with Youth Unlimited, and he told me actually this afternoon he's going to a shower for a 16-year-old male, a father, to be part of a support system in a community that he knows he's not alone. And so to be pro-life is to do exactly the things that Matt is doing, to celebrate and equip single dads and single moms whose significant other has left them and don't know what they're doing. That is gospel living. That is where we come alongside and say, I'm not just going to say something, but I'm going to actually do something. To be pro-life is also to care for women after they've had an abortion. And here we come full circle to say this, that we are not here to shame people who have. We are not here to condemn them or judge them. We are here, and please, whether it be in our church community as a whole, or our little church communities, on our streets, or in our families, or we know people, Lord, may we be people of grace as we come up against, bump up our relationships with people who have had one, who have had an abortion. To be pro-life is to care for them, to support them, accept them, befriend them, be a community to them. And to be pro-life is actually to consider and to value another alternative, and that is adoption. And with this, I want to invite Ryan Harvey up. Ryan's going to share. I've got one more story to share after, and then we're done this part here. But Ryan, come and share your amazing story about what adoption has looked like in your life. Thank you for being here this morning.
Yeah, of course. All right. So my name's Ryan. I was the youth band director at the Walnut Grove campus for about 5 years. So I'd like to take full credit for Max, who's playing acoustic this morning, but realistically I can't because he's better than me. I'm adopted. My mom was 18 when I was born, my birth mom, Jenny, and my birth father was not anywhere in the picture, so she had this choice to make all on her own, whether she was going to keep me or have an abortion. And she was too afraid to tell her parents, so I was actually a secret from her parents for 4 years. She was so afraid to tell them what she'd done, that she was raised in a Catholic church here in Abbotsford, and so she decided to go to one outside of Abbotsford to talk to a priest who wouldn't recognize her. And so she went and said, look, this is the situation I'm in, and I've put myself here, and I don't know what to do. Because if I have this baby, I'm 18, I know that I'm not going to give him the life that I want for him. And so it seems like my only other option is abortion. And after a long conversation, this priest said, look, there is a third option. We know that your heart is breaking, thinking that you might have to have an abortion. And so there's this third option nobody really talks about, and it's called adoption. There are lots of couples out there who can't have children on their own, and they're looking desperately for a child. And if you feel like that's what you should do, we can find people who are looking for a child. And so she decided that was the way she wanted to go. And I got really lucky. She was looking for couples who were hoping for a child, and she ran into her best friend's mom at the grocery store. And her best friend's mom is now my aunt, because she said, look, my brother and his wife can't have kids, and they're looking for one. And so my parents adopted me, moved me to San Diego, which was really nice of them, and raised me there. And from a very young age, they told me, look, like, we're your parents, but there's also this lady in Canada who loves you very much, and her name is Jenny. Jenny came down to my birthday party when I was turning four, which is also when she told my grandparents about me. Apparently, I was four, so I had these plastic swords, and so she took me on this walk where I was fighting invisible bad guys while my mom made my birthday cake. And then I ran up to her randomly. She's told me this story a bunch of times. I don't remember it. She said, I ran up to her and I said, I used to be in your tummy, you know? She looks at me and goes, oh, I know, kid. But you were too little, so you gave me to mom and dad, right? She said, yeah, that's right. Okay. And back to fighting my invisible bad guys. My parents raised me from a very young age to understand that Jenny loved me so much that she gave me to them. My adopted mom, God made her to be a mother. But unfortunately, her body wouldn't let her. And so she got this opportunity because somebody told Jenny that there's a third option that people don't talk about, that the media doesn't talk about, because somebody told her, I'm alive, I'm here, and I have this huge family. Now that I'm married, I have three moms, and my room has never been cleaner. I was actually at Jenny's house last night talking to her about what I was going to talk about this morning. And she said that if there's anybody here, or if you know anybody here who's going through this decision, whether they're alone or they have somebody to help them through it, if they're looking for somebody to talk to who doesn't know them, because that's what my mom needed, just let me know or let Jeff know. We're friends on Facebook, so he can tell me. And she said he gave me full permission to give people her phone number. She used to work at the crisis hotline at Pregnancy Options. And so she said, anybody who needs help, please give them my number. I'm happy to talk to them. So if you know someone or if you are someone who's going through this decision, please let me or Jeff or Matthew or somebody know. You can get my contact information. I will get you in touch with my mom. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you so much. Isn't that awesome? I want to just finish off with this story. It's a story from a family in our greater church who attend the Walnut Grove campus. They walked through the painful process of finding out years ago that their 14-year-old daughter was pregnant. She was in grade 9. And you can imagine the questions that confronted them and how their world changed immediately. But what were they to do? Well, she has amazing parents who loved her. That's what they did. And in that, they homeschooled her for the year so that she could quietly be pregnant in the safety of her parents' home. They loved her and cared for her through the pregnancy. She went with her mom to a center that cared for her and showed her numerous families that were willing to adopt her baby, and she picked a family to adopt her child. She gave birth to a baby boy, and at the age of 14, she gave birth to a baby boy at the age of 14. Sorry, she was 14 when she gave birth to the baby boy. And 10 days later, she gave her son to the family who adopted him. Now, fast forward this 14 years. And now the older mom, who was then 14, is now 28, gets a call. And on the other end of the phone is her now 14-year-old son, saying that he would love to meet her. That meeting took place. And she said that meeting was beautiful. And since that meeting, both families have remained close. That little boy is now 30 years old. He has children of his own. And so these two amazing parents and their daughter, her son who is now 30, and his two boys, actually with their spouses and as one big happy family, came to the Walnut Grove campus and worshiped together on Easter Sunday, this past Easter. How amazing is that? A teenage girl choosing to have her baby, and now the whole family benefits. This is what the grandparents said anonymously, but they wanted to say this. Even though we questioned and wrestled with God, he would never let go of us. As we clung to his promises, he showed us that when we needed him, and he gave us strength to wait upon him until our lives came full circle. Even if we never met our grandson, it would have been enough to have handled the situation to him and feeling that peace that comes with trusting him. Beautiful. I don't know where this will take you. Maybe it'll be discussion in a life group if you're a part of one. Maybe a group of friends. Maybe in your family. And maybe yourself, just to think and ponder through some of these issues that we've talked about today. But may God give us grace and understanding as we talk about this whole issue of the sanctity of life at the beginning of life.